The recession is over. Don't ask, don't tell is not. Politicians go for sin taxes. A college education pays off. Boys run in girls' races in America, while girls dress like boys in Afghanistan. It's Wednesday, September 22, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. A panel of prominent economists has declared that the recession is over. As USA Today and other major media are reporting, this panel of economists suggests that the Great Recession, as it is now called, actually began in December of 2007 and ended in June 2009. Now, this 18-month recession dates as now the longest since World War II. There had been at least two 16-month recessions since that period, but this recession, going from 2007 to 2009, now ranks as the longest since the Second World War. Now, looking at the data that has come in terms of this analysis, it's clear that this recession is different not only in terms of duration, but in terms of the impact. Many people, even now, feel as if they are in a recession. Unemployment. The rates are now still so high that it appears that unemployment is going to stay for some time at the rates that are associated with the recession. The unevenness of this recession is also becoming more and more clear. Certain states have suffered far more than others. For instance, the states of Nevada and Florida have been economically devastated to a degree that is not shared by some other states. States with heavy investments in energy, such as Texas, are actually doing much better. And states that have a great deal of government investment, such as New Mexico, now lead the pack. Now, when it comes to a recession, or to the larger context of economic analysis, this is a reminder to us that the economy is a moral factor. It is actually a reflection of how we do business together. It is about morale, about confidence in the economy, and it's about the sense in which people are ready to look to the future with capital and investment, believing that they will get a return on that investment. An economy is a great moral experiment. A culture is made up of many different dimensions, but the economic relationships that are central to a culture become demonstrated in terms of the strength of the culture in how the economy functions or fails to function. A recession is not necessarily a matter of damaged morals, or it can be, however, a sign that the culture itself is undergoing transformations and the economy is actually a lagging indicator of those changes. When it comes to many of the economic shifts that are going on around us, shifts related to energy, shifts related to education, shifts related to all kinds of developments in different sectors of our society, the recession may actually have amplified trends that were underway for some time, but became undeniable in the economic pressure of a recession that certainly for many people felt like a depression. Yesterday in the United States Senate, an effort to tie the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy to the 2011 Defense Authorization Bill failed by filibuster. Led by Republicans, the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell is now going to stall until at least after the Pentagon brings its report to the Congress after December the 1st. Now, this is very interesting. The timing of this particular effort, as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada tied this to the Defense Authorization Bill, indicates that the election upcoming in November was very much on the horizon. The Democratic Party was playing to constituencies calling for, indeed demanding, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. At the same time, the Republicans were appealing to their own constituency and serving that expectation that the defense policy Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that means that openly declared homosexuals may not serve in the United States military, will be in place until at least after the Pentagon brings its analysis. Now, the momentum against Don't Ask, Don't Tell is undeniable. The American people have demonstrated a significant shift in their own moral opinion on this, and to a greater or lesser degree, politicians of any party have to pay attention to that kind of shift. But something else is also here afoot. Of course, in recent weeks, a federal court has declared that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is actually unconstitutional, as it violates both the First and Fifth Amendments in the judgment of that federal judge. Of course, that federal judge put herself in the position of declaring herself superior to the Pentagon in judging whether or not the United States military would demonstrate significant readiness for deployment in combat. Eventually, this will become a matter of both litigation and legislation. But the issue here, especially with this vote coming yesterday, is a signal that as we get closer to the November election, things are likely to get a bit dicier and hotter in both houses of Congress. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy will not go away. This filibuster will not end the effort to repeal the policy. It will be back regardless of what happens in the November elections, but there is likely to be a different shape of how that policy is reshaped on the other side of both the judge's decision and the election when we get into the new Congress seated in just a few weeks. This particular issue serves as an indicator of the fact that elections have consequences. The election of President Bill Clinton in the year 1992 led to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy because President Clinton sought to repeal the military's prohibition on openly homosexual persons serving in the military. Congressional and military opposition prevented President Clinton, soon after assuming office in 1993, from imposing his own personal dictate. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was, as its title suggests, a compromise. But it's a compromise that has served relatively well over the last, now, almost two decades. Those who are pushing for the normalization, the full normalization of homosexuality, see the military, even as they see marriage, as a normalizing institution that simply has to give way to their agenda. Given the centrality of the military in American culture, given the pervasiveness in which military relationships become a signal to the rest of the society, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is going to be a central focus of cultural controversy for months to come. There should be more controversy about another issue on our political horizon. Christina Trinco, writing in USA Today, points to the fact that when economic times get tight, when state budgets are looking at shortfalls, politicians often look to a raise in sin taxes as a way of closing the gap. These sin taxes, however, have heavy moral ramifications throughout the culture. She writes about the fact that politicians look to increase taxes on alcohol and tobacco, even sugared drinks and fatty foods, horse racing, and other kinds of so-called sin in order to gain a margin of income for their states. Now, without doubt, many of these things that are taxed and called sin taxes are indeed sin. There's simply no doubt about it. Other things are simply activities that fall into disfavor. Some of them, like prostitution, believe it or not, legal in at least one of our states, is a sign that sin really is what is taxed here. But it's getting more complicated. The state of California will consider in November whether to legalize the sale of marijuana. If the state legalizes this sale and taxes marijuana, there is the promise from some economic predictions that that could bring in $1.4 billion a year. That's just on the tax in one state on marijuana. Now imagine the temptations to a politician looking at the possibility of legalizing a substance and then selling it, having the sale regulated and taxed and bringing in almost $1.5 billion in revenue. That's a very tempting argument. But consider for a moment what this does. It puts the state in the position of preying upon its own citizens. These taxes are called sin taxes for a reason. Now the state will put itself in the position of having to incentivize its own citizens participating in these sins in order to gain the taxes. Just consider this experiment in California. If indeed marijuana is legalized, then regulated, then taxed, if indeed the state of California does this, at least in part because it hopes to reap almost $1.5 billion in annual taxes, the state of California will now have an economic interest in more and more of its citizens actually using marijuana. Now just imagine the moral revolution that that represents. The same thing is true when it comes to state lotteries and taxes on gambling. In order for the state to have increased income, more of its people have to put their income at risk in order to gamble. The same thing comes with alcohol. When the state regulates and sells alcohol and charges a steep tax, it is actually having to incentivize more persons to drink more alcohol in order to gain more tax income. The argument on this is certain to be hot, state by state, different syntaxes are being considered. But one of the interesting things to note as you look across the United States over the last 20 or 30 years is how many of these taxes that were localized in one state quickly bleed over the borders into other states as well. The reason is quite simple to understand. How can one state gain that kind of income and the neighboring states not be jealous? Syntaxes are called syntaxes for a reason. There's a very interesting report now out indicating that the value of a college degree is higher on the other side of the Great Recession even than it was before. The College Board released this study on Tuesday indicating, and here's one interesting fact, that the average college graduate pays for that college education in terms of future income by age 33. That means from age 33 onward, the college education is adding income and benefit without any cost in terms of annual income. Now, this is a massive report that is indicating that the recession, instead of leveling out the differences between those who do and do not hold college degrees, actually has served to amplify that distinction. The distinction in income, in terms of annual income, is now $21,000. Those who hold a bachelor's degree are likely to gain a median income of $55,700 in 2010 dollars. Meanwhile, those who do not have a baccalaureate degree, but have only a high school education, will earn $21,900 less. That's a very significant sum. Now, of course, there's some leveling issues here. There are some tradesmen who can make more than some college graduates. This is a median comparison. This is an average. But it is another signal of just how we have moved into an information economy, into a knowledge economy, in which the education gained by means of a baccalaureate degree is becoming something of a new normal, a new standard. The phrase that a college degree is what used to be a high school diploma is a signal that in a society like ours, a high school degree has now been largely marginalized in terms of economic benefit. Now, one of the things that simply has to be asserted here is that for a college degree to pay off, as the conference board and here the College Board indicates, is likely over a period of time up to age 33, the student is going to have to avoid taking on excessive debt. And this means that the choice of a college and the expenses related to that college are an unavoidable question for both parents and students. For a degree to pay off, the student has to be able to pay off the debt. There are two absolutely incredible stories having to do with gender. One is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. The other is on the front page of yesterday's edition of the New York Times. First, in the Wall Street Journal, Kevin Hellicker is reporting that an increasing number of men are running in races and marathons that are designed for women. It's not actually a small number. Even as the men are outnumbered in many of these races, there's a considerable number of men who are doing this. For instance, Jonathan Medeiros is profiled, who set a personal record in Disney's Princess Half Marathon last year, winning first place with a time of 1 hour, 16 minutes, and 17 seconds. Now, this is absolutely stunning. You have races, half marathons in this case, that are designed for women, but men are running in them. And why? Well, the answer is simple and straightforward, and the men are not hiding their ambition. They come ahead. Men who would end up in the middle of the pack or the last third if they were running against other men can end up with much higher rankings, if not a much easier win, when running against women. Now, many of the sponsors of these marathons designed for women are trying to do their best to disincentivize men from running in the races. They are awarding trophies only to women. They are giving away gifts that are clearly intended only for women. But why is this now such a possibility? Why are there men running in these races, and why is it allowed? Well, this has to do with what might be seen as something of a tripwire as a joke on Title IX. Title IX is the law that says that in colleges, and for that matter, the larger academic world, sports teams have to be equalized between men and women. An effort pushed by women, driven by feminists, to remove all distinctions between men and women is now coming back to bite them when it comes to women's marathons. The sponsors of these marathons cannot actually limit participation to women, or they will trip the same kind of legal challenges that they have brought against events only for men. The Wall Street Journal article about men running in women's races is interesting and informative. It's something of a clue that there is great confusion in this society, and there's something of a payback in terms of how that story is contextualized. But the story in the New York Times on the front page of yesterday's edition is far sadder. It shows a color picture of three children, two girls dressed as girls, and what appears to be a boy, but is actually a girl dressed as a boy. The story is from Afghanistan. And reporter Jenny Nordberg reports on how many Afghan families, so desirous of a boy, when they are not going to have an actual boy, often dress up one of their daughters as a boy, present this child as a boy to the public, allow the child or force the child to dress like a boy, play like a boy, go to school like a boy, and even work as a boy. Well, there is a deep confusion at the very heart of this culture. These girls, known as bacha posh, dress up as boys. It is becoming a phenomenon that is more visible here in the West because, of course, of the engagement of Western nations in the war in Afghanistan. Now, this is interesting because in recent weeks there have been increased attention to boy prostitutes in Afghanistan. You might say it's the mirror story to this story. Because of the sexual segregation, the gender segregation in Afghanistan, men who cannot be in the presence of women dress up boys as girls, as exotic dancers, and in many cases this bleeds over into prostitution with these boys that are basically involved in sex trafficking. The flip side of that is what the New York Times is reporting in this front page story. Families desperate for sons dress up a girl as a boy. Now, there's a limitation to this, of course. When the child reaches puberty, the child undeniably shows up as a female rather than as a male, and there's a transition back to some kind of female identity. But there's a deep sadness in this. The missing girls that are the phenomenon of abortions and infanticide in India and China are here connected in this story to the girls that are forced to dress up, to play, and to present themselves as boys. There is a preference for male children in so many parts of the world that come down to these absolutely bizarre, tragic, and devastating phenomena. The story in the New York Times is quite complicated, but it comes down to the simple fact that a preference for boys leads to an imbalance in worldview, and it leads to severe consequences in the lives of these children and families. Here again, we have the affirmation that a biblical understanding of the importance of gender, the clarity of gender, and yes, the gift of gender is the only corrective. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a host of materials for you at my website at albertmohler.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. You'll find a wealth of resources and information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary at sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.